Okay, so we can start, and today we're going to pursue our idea of looking at modern translations. We're just going to do Jewish translations. I mean, there are some very good non-Jewish translations out there, but there's a limit to what we can do. And today I thought we'd particularly look at some current ones that are around, and think about how you choose a translation. The first thing I'm going to say is you should always have more than one translation around. And if you only have one in the house, buy another one. Because once you start using them together, you'll see that they reveal an awful lot about the original text. And here we have, I called it choosing the right translation. I put right in quotation marks because there is no one overall right translation, I think. Different people want different things. So that's a very, very important point to make at the beginning, is that you should have a real, really good think about what is it you want in a translation before you buy one for you or indeed for anyone else. And we'll just sort of think about some of the factors you might be looking for, some of the aspects you might want to take into account. So for instance, if you're looking at any translation, the first thing you need to decide is who has that translation been made for? And again, we were just talking, there are translations that that are made by Christians. There are translations made by Jews. Sometimes they're intended for Jews or for Christians particularly, or sometimes they are translations not intended for any particular religion at all. So that might be important to you. Sometimes they are made with an aim of educating people about the biblical background. That might be something you want, you don't want. They could be made for study purposes, for reading aloud, for meditation or inspiration, for literary enjoyment. And they could conform to a particular worldview, religious, non-religious, a particular denomination. So all those are very, very important factors when we come to think, what sort of translation do I want? And then there are lots of individual questions that only you will be able to answer for yourselves. What degree of literalness do you like? You might prefer a smooth read with certain liberties taken to smooth out the bumps in the Hebrew original when it comes into English, or you might really want to get as close as you can to the Hebrew. If you're, for instance, using a translation to back up your newly acquired Hebrew skills and you want something to bounce off, you might very well want one that's extremely literal so you can check your understanding as you go along. Or you just might want to read it and get a fluent sense of what a particular biblical book is about. Again, you might be interested in study, in which case you might want a Tanakh that comes with commentary or with notes or background information. You might want something that has an academic approach, or a non-denominational one, or you might say, I want this hechted and certified, and I want to know that this comes from some sort of authorized position. You might want something that gives you a very emotional connection to the text. You might be interested in literary quality and beauty. You might be interested, and this is something that doesn't get looked at very often, in a very attractive presentation and very clear fonts, because there are some Tanakhim which are hard to read simply because, it's old-fashioned font or the layout isn't very good. It may be important to you that poetry is shown as poetry, sort of arranged in lines. That may not be important to you at all. You might want to know what the policy was of the translators, and the idea behind the translation might concern you. You might want to be surprised and stimulated. You might be looking for majesty in antiquity. And last and definitely not least, you might want a translation that has Hebrew facing it. Or you might just want the English without the Hebrew. So all those considerations are extremely important, and that's not the sort of thing I could decide for you at all. But you really should think about what sort of Tanakh are you looking for, and don't just buy the first one you see. Investigate. Make sure it's a good fit. So we're going to survey some of the main Jewish Bible translations available. Alas, we don't have time to do them all, so I've chosen six, including the very latest one. And well, first of all, I'm just going to get rid of some of the ones we're not going to look at today, either because they're a bit old-fashioned or you'll hear why. So first of all, I'm not going to look at the famous Hertz Chumash, which was came out under the aegis of Joseph Hertz, the chief rabbi of Britain and the British Empire. back in 1936. And you may have a copy of this. It's bound in blue, and it's called The Commentary on the Pentateuch and the Haftorahs. And it used to be the main pew Bible in the UK. I think it was widely used in the USA as well. I don't know what its fate was in Canada, but I'm guessing it reached Canada as well, and everyone used to know it. It is falling out of favour, partly because it's a bit dated now, partly because of the growth of the Haredi sector and the rise of art scroll, which pushed, certainly in the UK, pushed a lot of the Hertz Chumashes off the shelves and into the bin. So from the point of view of the translation, which is what we're really looking at here, it's not interesting. It's the old Jewish Publication Society translation of 1917. So there's absolutely nothing to see in that translation. It's not original to that particular edition. I'm similarly not going to look at the Plaut, the Gunter Plaut Chumash, which is officially titled The Torah, A Modern Commentary. And that is the official Chumash of the Reform Movement, at least in the USA, because that uses the new JPS. So again, we'll look at that under the new JPS translation. And we'll also leave out the old JPS from 1917, which was very strongly modelled on the King James and is rather archaic in language. So we're just not going to really talk about those. We'll talk about some much more recent ones, and we'll deal with them in alphabetical order, well, in chronological order, not alphabetical. And the first one I want to think about is Aria Kaplan's The Living Torah. So one second, and I will share the screen. There we are. Okay. So Aria Kaplan himself, most interesting man, tragically died terribly young, at the age of about 49. I think he had a heart attack. Very, very sad indeed. He was an American Orthodox rabbi. He had a degree in physics. He translated a lot of Bratslava and other mystical texts, and he wrote several books, which you may know, about Hasidic thought and Kabbalah, and particularly about Jewish meditation. His book, that's just called Jewish Meditation, is very well known and widely, widely sold. And a friend of his described him. He said that he saw harmony between science and Judaism, where many others saw otherwise. So he was a very creative thinker, very original, and anchored his thought very much in classical rabbinic literature. And his translation is in modern English, which at the time was bucking the trend somewhat. This came out, as you can see, that the first volume, Living Torah, came out in 1981. And he was interested in producing a translation that will be relevant for the time. There are extensive notes, there are cross-references to other verses, there's background information, references to other texts, and it's quite a literal translation. Unfortunately, he didn't have time to do anything more than the Torah. And you can see the Living Nach was done actually by Yaakov Ellman in 1994 and 96, and Volume 3, Sacred Writings, that's Ketuvim, was done by Moshe Shapiro to other people in 1998. So Kaplan himself only did the Torah. So it was new. It did use Jewish traditional literature, and for the Torah, certainly it's a single author translation. And that's something else you might be interested in, because some translations of Tanakh are multiple author translations. There's a whole team of translators working. We'll see that in a moment. It's also important to know which Hebrew text are they working off. We've seen something about variations in the Masoretic text and the different standards of Hebrew text out there. It doesn't actually say, and that's quite an interesting thing. It's probably what's known as the traditional Masoretic text, which comes from the Second Rabbinic Bible of 1546, 1547, which actually has a lot of errors in. So the traditional unattributed text is not a very good text to translate from. You'd be better off with something like a text based on the Aleppo Codex or the Leningrad Codex or something like that. So usually in the Orthodox world, people aren't very interested in telling you what Hebrew text they use. They just assume there's one text without knowing. In all cases, it's interesting always to look at the introduction of a translation, because that's where the translator will tell you about the principles, the thought behind the translation, the aims of the translation, and that may very well be where you find what attracts you or doesn't attract you. So let's have a little look at part of his introduction. He says, the philosophy of this translation has been to treat the Torah as a living document. Our sages teach that every day the Torah should be as new. This indicates that even a translator may not treat the Torah as an archaic document. It also implies that archaic or obsolete must be used when translating the Torah, because the language gives the impression of the Torah being old, not new. But that's very interesting. I haven't seen that anywhere else at all, but he really feels that it's a mitzvah to use contemporary language, and that if you use these and thous or words with which people are not familiar, you are in some way transgressing this commandment. He goes on to say, wherever there is a dispute regarding the meaning of a passage, the decision as to which interpretation to use has been based primarily on literary judgments. And that's an interesting principle. If you have multiple interpretations of a difficult passage, go with the one that is most satisfactory from a literary viewpoint. And we'll see, not all translations do that. The fact that one opinion is favored over another is not meant to imply that we consider that opinion the most accurate. He's very careful to say it is not a definitive translation, that opinions may vary. He's quite happy with that, and he's not claiming that this is the only way the Tanakh could be translated, which I rather like. Again, it gives you a window into the multiplicity of interpretation of traditional Jewish commentary. It doesn't always agree. Then he says, if we have chosen the opinion of one commentator, it is only because his interpretation provides the simplest and clearest translation. Then, important, the only exception to this has been where Torah law is concerned, halachic material. Here, we have consistently translated the passages so that they reflect the final decision in Jewish law. For the most part, this means following Maimonides' codes, the Yad, or the Mishneh Torah. Quite interesting that he follows the Mishneh Torah, because I think a lot of people would have gone for the Shulchan Aruch or the Mishneh Berurah or something like that. So there are places where rabbinic understandings of the Torah don't actually agree with the pshat, with the literal meaning at all. And that's the place, that's those places are where Ariel Kaplan decided he would go with the rabbinic opinion and he wouldn't translate those literally. So that's an interesting translation. It's a nice translation in many ways because it has some quite surprising bits. It has very fresh, innovative approach. Sometimes it's a little quirky. I wouldn't say it's absolutely mainstream, but it's a creative translation. It's worth looking at it. Against it, as far as I know, you can't get it in one volume. You have to have three separate volumes, and it ends up very, very bulky. And certainly the editions I've seen don't have Hebrew on the facing page. So if that's an important consideration for you, that might not be your prime choice. But if you want something that's deeply, deeply rooted in Jewish tradition, and is interesting and creative, this might be a serious one to choose. He does generally use, or apparently only uses, Jewish commentators, but he doesn't make a big thing of not using non-Jewish commentators. It's not a principle with him like it is with Art Scroll. So at least in the bits I've seen, I can see somebody shaking their head, so maybe there are bits that I don't know where he does use non-Jewish commentators. But I don't think that's a central principle for him. I think he would be quite interested with anyone's opinion, really. He is deeply, deeply rooted in traditional commentary, but I don't think this is a translation that shuts down alternatives ahead of time. So, yeah, it's quite nice. I rather like it. We'll sample a bit later. On we move to the New Jewish Publication Society. This came out in 1985. It took various stages. The Torah part came out in 1962. Nevi'im came out in 1978, Ketuvim in 1982. And then they revised the whole thing all over again and published it as one lot in 1985. So that's the latest edition of the New Jewish Publication Society. And this is a committee translation, not one person. It's totally new. It uses all the available material, by which I mean it looks at the Septuagint, it looks at alternative ancient versions, it considers, it doesn't alter the text, but it considers often in the footnotes things like the Dead Sea Scrolls. So they're using everything that's out there. It's academic rather than from, you could say. They describe the source of the Hebrew text they use as traditional, but from 1999 on, in their bilingual editions, they are actually using the Leningrad Codex text as the Hebrew. So I'm not sure that was used as the base for the translation, but it's certainly what you get now if you get a bilingual edition. And this was done by Orthodox, Conservative and Reform academics, scholars and rabbis all together. So it's a very cross-denominational translation that, again, is important to some people, not to other people. It appears in different places. We mentioned already that Gunter Plaut's Torah, a modern commentary, that is based on this translation. The Etz Chaim, which is the Conservative Pew Bible, is this translation. Oxford University Press's Jewish Study Bible, very useful thing to have, again, uses this translation. I would say it's not as quite as literal, oddly enough, as some of the other Jewish versions. It's a little bit paraphrastic, as we spoke about last time. Take some liberties to make it sound quite smooth, to iron out some of the difficulties. But they're very good about marking difficulties in footnotes, and they'll often say meaning of Hebrew uncertain, or they'll say other translations are, and give you a couple of alternatives. Another advantage is it's available in many, many different sizes, from pocket versions. It's also available in English only versions, as well as the Hebrew and English versions. It's one I use quite a lot. I've got a little tiddly one that strains my eyes. That's Hebrew and English. Very handy for travel. So it's got a lot of advantages. It presents the poetry as poetry, which I personally like, but which might not be important to you. And it's they're quite upfront about their translation policy, so that's interesting. So we'll look a little bit at the preface here. And first of all, I want to look at one detail, which is something, again, that people had strong opinions about, and it's interesting they thought it was worth discussing. And that's, what do you do with the biblical vav? As you probably know, vav usually means and. Sometimes it appears as u in front of certain letters. But in biblical Hebrew, it does other things. So they thought about this. They've said a further obvious difference between this translation and most of the older ones is in the rendering of the Hebrew particle vav, which is usually translated and. Biblical Hebrew demanded the frequent use of the vav, but in that style, it had the force not only of and, but also of however, but, yet, when, and any number of other such words and particles. Or none at all that could be translated into English. Always to render it as and is to misrepresent the Hebrew rather than to be faithful to it. Consequently, the committee translated the particle as the sense required or left it untranslated. So that may surprise people who are used to older translations where most verses begin with and he said, and the Lord said to Moses, etc. So you won't get that sort of familiar feel in the new JPS. If we look at broader issues, they talk about their attitude to what do you do when you hit a passage where clearly it's very hard to understand, or where perhaps something has gone wrong with the text, which you do in the Nevi'im a lot. The book of Samuel is notorious. So they say the prophetic books contain many passages whose meaning is uncertain. Thus, in order to provide an intelligible meaning, modern scholars have resorted to amending the Hebrew text, i.e. changing the traditional text. Some of these amendations derive from the ancient translations, especially the Septuagint and the Targums, who had before them a Hebrew text that sometimes differed from today's traditional text, and we already looked at evidence for that in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Where these ancient versions provide no help, some scholars have made conjectural emendations of their own. And we did talk about that, particularly in the context of some Christian Bible translations. We saw that in the translation of Psalm 82, where letters were moved around to make a new word. But many modern English versions contain translations of amended texts, sometimes without citing any departure from the traditional Hebrew text. We noted that. Like the translation of the Torah, the present translation of the prophetic books adheres strictly to the traditional Hebrew text. So they have stuck with the Masoretic text. They have not amended it. But where the text remains obscure and an alteration provides marked clarification, a footnote is offered with a rendering of the suggested emendation. So if they have got a comment and they say, well, we have a Dead Sea Scroll, a basis for this reading of the text, they'll put it in the footnote. you can ignore the footnotes if you're not interested in that sort of thing. Sometimes it was deemed sufficient to offer only a change of vowels, a much less revolutionary thing to do. And such modifications are indicated by change of vocalization yields. In other words, if you do change the vowels here, you could read it this way. In all cases, the emendation is given in a footnote, which may be readily disregarded by those who reject it on either scholarly or religious grounds. So they're giving you options. Personally, I like that in translation. I like translations to be upfront about what they're doing and let you make decisions. So that for me would be an advantage. On the other hand, for some people, they say, well, no, I'm sorry. The Masoretic text is the Masoretic text. I don't want to know about anyone's emendations. Not interested. Other things, well, it has got massive scholarship behind it. The world experts at the time were involved in that translation. Cons, you might not want a translation that is quite as free. It's not a very free translation, but when you compare it with more literal ones, it does look remarkably unliteral in places. So that might bother various people. If I give you an example of the attitude to emendation, we talked about the missing paragraph from the first book of Shmuel, of Samuel, that was found at the Dead Sea Scrolls and really seems to have been part of the original text. The way JPS, the new JPS handles that is not to incorporate in the text, but to have an allusion to it in a footnote. So again, they're not saying, here's the whole paragraph. They just say, Dead Sea Scroll material suggests that this could be read in this way. So it's again, quite low key. They don't muck around with the traditional text. Okay, so that's quite a good contender. It's a useful translation. Use that one quite a bit too. Everett Fox, something completely different. We did mention Everett Fox a little bit. He has not done the whole Tanakh. He did the five books of Moses, and in 2014 he published Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, the early prophets. I don't know if he's intending to do any more or not. Now, again, this is a single author translation, completely new, and it follows the principles of Martin Buber and Franz Rosenzweig, who were talking about German translations, but the same idea that you have to try and represent the quality of the Hebrew, that you're not trying to provide a nice English document that looks like a nice English document and you'd never know it had started off in another language. For Fox and Buber and Rosenzweig, it's a Hebrew document. So every time you translate it, it has to sound like a Hebrew document. It shouldn't sound English. It should sound different. And this is a very, very basic principle with him. Again, the source of the Hebrew text is the traditional Masoretic text, but he mentions any departures he makes in the notes. So again, you get a heads up if he changes anything. And here, again, it's pretty important to understand what he's trying to do. His departure is that the Bible was intended to be heard, which it seems reasonable in the context of a world where maybe 5% of people were literate. It's up to, well, maybe that could have gone well up to the Hellenistic period. So most people's encounter with Tanakh was through their ears. And it's so then this is a text that's designed to be heard. And that has to be primary when you're translating it. So he says, once the spokenness of the Bible is understood as a critical factor in the translation process, a number of practical steps become necessary, which constitute radical change from past translation practices. First, the translated text is printed in lines resembling blank verse. So he literally does it according to where you breathe. The Et Nachtaz and the cantillation marks, the Te'amim, are very useful for this. So he breaks it up into spoken phrases and presents them as you would blank verse. These kola are placed primarily on spoken phrasing. Second, personal and place names generally appear in Hebrew forms throughout this translation. So he might not say Jerusalem, he'd probably say Yerushalayim, and not Moses, but Moshe. This practice stems from the central role that names play in biblical stories. The meaning of a name is often explained outright in the text itself. In the five books of Moses, this is represented by a slash in the text. So you might have Moshe slash drawn from the water. And all the names will be translated in that way so that you know what all the biblical characters' names means and also the place names, because they do have meaning and it's part of the story. A third important technique with which biblical literature often conveys its message and which must influence the translation of the text, is what Buber calls the leading word, or Leitwort. In Hebrew, it's Milat Manche, principle. Key or leading words are repeated within a text to signify major themes and concerns, like recurring themes in a piece of music. We mentioned this in an earlier session also, for instance, in the Tower of Babel story, you have Shem and Sham constantly. And we actually saw an example of it in Jacob's encounter with Esav. In the Fox translation, the word panim, or face, is translated as face every time it appears, so that you can see there are five instances in quite a small number of verses, and that this is patterned language. Just about every other translation misses that feature. So again, this brings you back to the Hebrew original much, much more closely. A leading word operates on the basis of sound. The repetition of a word or word root encourages the listener to make connections between diverse parts of a story or even of a book, and to trace a particular theme throughout. Such an understanding of the role of leading words is crucial to the sound. Really makes itself felt in translations. It's very, very true indeed. Usually it's invisible in English translation. Bible translators are reluctant to reproduce repetitions of Hebrew words in the text because they are generally fearful of creating a tedious English style. Paul said, I don't really care about the English style. What I care is that you know you're reading a book that was read in Hebrew and that these features of the text are available to you. You can see them. So again, it's a completely different style of translation. It's this rhetorical translation style. Some people hate it. Some people love it. As we said before, if you are practicing your own translation skills, Fox is useful because it's much easier to confirm what you're doing against Fox than it is against a smoothed out translation like the new JPS. Again, it can be surprising. Connections can hit you in the face that you never noticed before, if you've always read a smoothed out English translation. But it is quite specialized. The other main thing against it is we don't have a complete Bible translation yet. It's just Torah and Nevi'im Rishonim. We have to see if he produces any more. But it's an interesting translation. If you want to get close to the text and you have no Hebrew or limited Hebrew, Fox is one of the best ways to do it. Now we move on to Art Scroll. Art Scroll, which is everywhere. Art Scroll has a whole history. In 1976, a company called Masura Publications, which had actually started off on greeting cards rather weirdly, began publishing a series of bilingual Hebrew-English books of the Bible. And you may remember them. They came out in paperback. They had beautiful manuscripts or pictures on the front, and they had remarkably clear font and well-designed layout. They caught on very, very well. They started with Megillat Esther, and then they went on after that. And they've always been very well produced with nice covers and very easy to use. The books of the Torah were later issued as the Art Scroll Stone Chumash, including the Haftorah, so you could use it in Shul. And the entire set of books was combined, revised, and issued in 1996 as the Art Scroll Stone Tanakh, as the complete volume. So it's actually older than that, but that's the first time it appeared as a Tanakh. The translation follows Talmudic and Midrashic explanation rather than producing a more or less literal rendering of the text, but it doesn't tell you it does that. And we talked about this before. It's much more like a Targum. It tells you what the text means, not necessarily what the text says. And in this, it stands in contrast both to modern academic versions and also the best medieval scholarship like Ibn Ezra and others who are trying very much to look at the Pshat, the literal reading of Tanakh. So that does not interest Art Scroll so much. It takes a very principled stand on excluding all modern academic approaches at all. It says right out it's only using traditional Jewish material. It sometimes understands Midrash as historical in nature, but not always. And everything outside the world of mainstream Jewish tradition is completely ignored. So there are no references to or comments on modern biblical criticism, geology, paleontology, archaeology, any of the various disciplines that have been used to help understand the Bible are not used at all by Art Scroll. And in its avoidance of any reference to disagreements among traditional commentators, it's curiously untraditional itself, I have to say. It's much more closely resembles modern Christian fundamentalist approaches than it does anything traditional Jewish. There's a couple of very important articles about it that we haven't got time to look at, but Barry Levy wrote an extremely good article on Art Scroll, which I think was called Art Scroll, An Overview, which is available on the net. Norman Solomon has also written about Art Scrolls. I should think if you Googled those authors' names and the word Art Scroll, you'll probably come up with those. When we get onto the preface, it's a little bit confusing. And we'll see that because we'll look at it in a moment. Its literary qualities are low. It's a very bumpy read. We'll actually sample a little bit when we come to think about Shir HaShirim, which is the notorious part of the Art Scroll translation, you could say. Because it's like a Targum, because it presents itself as the one true version that doesn't actually mention the multiplicity of Jewish interpretation, it's a little bit odd. You don't get a very good impression of what the Tanakh is like from Art Scroll. You get directed into what it means according to Art Scroll. So it closes off quite a lot of avenues. Now, many, many people have Art Scroll because it flooded the market and it was widely available and there are all sorts of sizes of editions. And it's very nicely produced. It's beautiful, clear font and very, very high quality production values and layouts. So it's very attractive. But you really should know what you're getting. Or what you have, if you have one already. And I would never, never advise anyone to have just the Art Scroll. Have it if you want, sure, but have something else to act as a contrast and a corrective, because you do not get a very good idea of what the Tanakh actually says from Art Scroll. So the introduction or the preface is fascinating because it doesn't really seem to hang together. Again, just to sort of go through the actual translation, it's done by many different authors, so many different translators involved, and they were involved, and they were all revised later. So it's again, it's a multiple author translation. Source of the Hebrew text seems to be the traditional Masoretic text derived from the Second Rabbinic Bible, i.e., not a critical text, and maybe a text with some problems with it. Okay, so they say the first goal of a translation must be accuracy. No effort was spared in the successful quest of that goal. They've already decided they were successful. There's a slight lack of humility here that always amuses me. Also, they haven't defined accuracy. Accuracy in what sense? Scriptural Hebrew is laden with nuance and meaning. I think everyone would agree with that. The language is replete with allusion. And again, absolutely right. The scholars involved in this task were consumed with a sense of mission, that they were dealing with the sacred, eternal and eternal word of God, not mere literature, that their task was not to rewrite the text, but to convey its meaning faithfully. So there you are, they told you. That's what they're doing. They are not rewriting the text in a different language. They are telling you what it means. They're very upfront about it. But, you know, a literal understanding of the Tanakh, it ain't. So that's what you want. You want to know what the words say. Art Scroll will not always tell you. Sometimes it will, but very often it won't. The translation balances the lofty beauty of the Hebrew with the need to provide a literate and comprehensible English rendering. I think we'll have a little judgment about its English rendering later on when we sample it. Where a choice had to be made, now this is where I just don't know what they're talking about. We preferred fidelity to the text over inaccurate simplicity. I honestly do not know what that means, and I have read it many, many times. But occasionally we had to stray from the literal translation or Hebrew syntax in order to capture the essence of a phrase or to make it intelligible in English. And then I don't quite know how that fits together. I don't know what fidelity to the text means in this context. I really don't. In the Chumash portion of this work, the translation follows Rashi, the father of commentators, because the study of Chumash has been synonymous with Chumash Rashi for nine centuries. As I think we said last session, it does make Rashi look a bit stupid when you look at the Art Scroll Rashi, because he says exactly what's in the text. So by incorporating commentary into the text, that's already pretty problematic because it leaves no room for other commentary. In the prophets and writings, however, following the guidance of our great mentors, we are more eclectic. While the translation always follows an authoritative opinion, we try to choose the interpretation that would best fit the text and be as clear as possible to the reader, which sounds a little bit like what Aryeh Kaplan was saying, but I'm not absolutely sure it is. So it is a bit of, you know, caveat emptor. You need to know what the Art Scroll is intended to do and not mistake it for something that it doesn't intend to do at all. I mean, they are very upfront about it. If you read the preface, though, very few people read the prefaces to translations. So very often people are quite surprised when they discover that Art Scroll has just, you know, remodeled the sentence completely and changed the meaning. Okay, let's move on to Robert Alter. Robert Alter is an American academic born in 1935, still with us. He's written on American and modern Hebrew literature and the Bible, and his books include The Art of Biblical Narrative and The Art of Biblical Poetry, both of which I recommend unreservedly, wonderful books. He's particularly interested in the literary quality of the Bible, and to some extent he follows the Buber Rosenzweig and Everett Fox school because he's interested in the features of the language. He wants to make it sound like a Hebrew text, maybe not quite in such an extreme manner as Everett Fox, but certainly that's important to him. It's very important that the literary qualities within the Hebrew get translated as well. And his translation has a long and fascinating introduction with an entire section entitled The Bible in English and the Heresy of Explanation. It's now been published in an expanded version of a separate book, which again I highly recommend, a little book called The Art of Biblical Translation. It was published in 2019 by Robert Alter, and again, yes, by a wonderful book about biblical translation. So let's see what he says. He is, again, a single author. He did the whole Tanakh. It finally came out in 2019, took him years. He's using the traditional text, but he does consider emendations and other texts in the commentary. And he says, in the case of the modern versions, the modern translations, the problem is a shaky sense of English. And in the case of the King James version, a shaky sense of Hebrew. The present translation is an experiment in representing the Bible in a language that conveys with some precision the semantic nuances of a lively orchestration of literary effects of the Hebrew, and at the same time has stylistic and rhythmic integrity as literary English. The unacknowledged heresy underlying most modern English versions of the Bible is the use of translation as a vehicle for explaining the Bible instead of representing it in another language. So again, he wants to represent it, not to explain it, the polar opposite, you could say, from art scroll. I think JPS is somewhere in the middle. This, in the most egregious instances, this amounts to explaining away the Bible. This impulse may be attributed also to a feeling that the Bible, because of its canonical status, has to be made accessible, indeed transparent, to all. They think, doesn't matter if we don't understand it, we need to know what it says. You can't always explain bits of Tanakh. Biblical Hebrew, in sum, has a distinctive music, a lovely precision of lexical choice, a meaningful concreteness, and a suppleness of expressive syntax that by and large have been given short shrift by translators with their eyes on other goals. The present translation, whatever its imperfections, seeks to do fuller justice to all these aspects of biblical style in the hope of making the rich literary experience of the Hebrew more accessible to readers of English. So he is not interested in telling you what it means, but what it says. And he does that, to my mind, pretty well. Because his translation is accompanied by a very extensive commentary, it's about half the page, on how he translated it and possible choices and problems in the Hebrew, it is the ideal translation for a translator. If you are interested in how Hebrew works and how the Bible's actual Hebrew works, this is the translation for you. I think it reads well in the English as well, but his commentary is fabulous, absolutely fabulous. And if you're interested in that aspect of things, definitely the Alter should be one of the ones on your shelf. Then we come to, I think the main thing against it is it's printed all, it's just in English. It doesn't have the Hebrew facing the page, which is the thing I like. But again, you can always put the Hebrew near when you're reading it. Not the end of the world. Lastly, we're going to look at the new Koren translation. It's just come out this year. It's called the Magamon edition. And here again, we have a multiple author one. People are calling it the Rabbi Sachs translation. He translated the Torah and the Psalms, but that's actually all he did. Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb did Jeremiah Mishle, and then there's a whole band that the book refers to, scores of translators, under the supervision of Jessica Sachs, who was Rabbi Jonathan Sachs's granddaughter and is a superb translator in her own right, and somebody called Sarah Daniel, who I know nothing about at all, but dozens of people were involved in this. It's not a single author one at all. The source of the Hebrew text is interesting, and this is because it's Koren. Koren have their own Hebrew text, and they evolved this long time ago. It's based on an edition of the Masoretic text by Wolf Heidenheim and on the Leningrad Codex. And that was prepared in the 1950s by a team of Jewish scholars led by Eliyahu Koren, the founder of Koren Publishers. Uniquely, that Hebrew text, not the English, But the Hebrew text was approved by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. So there are Haskamas at the beginning on the Hebrew text, not on the English. And this is that was the first modern Hebrew edition of the Masoretic text, and was received with huge acclaim when it was made. And it's the Koran edition is still, I think, what the president of Israel takes the oath of office on. He's a Koran Hebrew edition. What about the modern translation? Well, it's brand new. They have dropped their old one, which was a very odd, if you had the old Koran Jerusalem Bible, it was very odd, sort of potch-potch. It's based on the King James with updates in the 19th century, and fiddling was around by Harold Fishman in the 1970s. Very odd. They are interested in keeping the Hebrew name. So you have Moshe and Abraham. You don't have Moses and Abraham. They've climbed down a bit from their purism of the first translation, where you had Yerushalayim and Mitzrayim. And if you didn't know Mitzrayim was Egypt, well, tough. So they will have things like Jerusalem and Egypt now, but they have kept most of the names in the Hebrew version. So they also have all the divisions of the Hebrew text marked, which is nice. They put chapter and verse in the margin, which again is quite nice because it doesn't interrupt the flow as you're reading. They have dropped some confusing things that were in the old edition, where they had the Sedarim, a division that nobody uses these days. They have them marked on the outer margins, and people constantly reading them as chapters and getting confused. So I think that's why they've dropped it. So the new translation, if we look at their introduction, says it aims to stand out to its emphasis on authentically conveying the Hadrat Kodesh, the sacred majesty of the original Hebrew. I'm not too sure about the word authentically. I find that troubling. Authentically according to who? Don't know. Still, more specifically, we have created a translation that is readable and stylistically sound to the modern eye and ear without comprising accuracy or scholarly integrity. And note again, they don't actually define what they mean by accuracy here. Whispers the tonality of the Hebrew original. I'm not sure what that means. Maintains the beauty and the majestic quality of the poetry and prose of Tanakh. So a lot of this seems to be adding up to there's an emphasis on literary qualities, on aesthetic qualities, which is nice. Is faithful to the classic Jewish interpretive tradition while cognizant of contemporary scholarship. So it's not art scroll. It doesn't say we don't want to know about academia. On the other hand, it is based on traditional sources, and it'll take academic input from the modern time, in modern times, when and as it finds it useful. Fair enough. Invites the contemporary reader to experience afresh the timeless stories and wisdom contained in the Hebrew scriptures. The translators' abilities, and again, this emphasis on literature. After translation, each text was edited and reviewed several times by leading scholars of biblical history, language, and literature, to ensure the high level of accuracy and integrity readers should expect. So it's a committee translation like the new JPS, with consummate skill and close attention to style. Literary art editors helped craft the translations in dialogue with the translators, followed the attentions of copy editors and consistency editors, as well as the rules of proofreading. So again, you're not guaranteed that this is Rabbi Sachter's exact translation. It's been through a lot of stages since he wrote it. Throughout, we prioritized the experience of the English with the aim that those holding this volume will forget that they are reading a translation. And this is the exact opposite of Alter and Fox, who want you to know always that you're reading an English version of a Hebrew original. And here, interestingly, Koran have actually said, no, they don't want you to know that. They want you just to think that's the original you're reading. So again, this may speak to some of you more than others. These are very different translation aims. And you may find that some of them you like, some of them you don't. Again, this is personal taste. Every translation is an interpretation, very true. While we have made use of contemporary approaches to understanding Tanakh, I think that's a veiled reference to academic approaches, we are also committed to the way the Tanakh, and in particular the Torah, has been received and understood in the Jewish tradition. In the instances where rabbinic reading was chosen against the apparent grain of the literal one, we have marked this with a footnote. That's what Ari Kaplan did. Okay, so it's fair enough. He was up front. He said, when we get to halacha, I'm going to translate it in accordance with the rabbinic interpretation. I'm presuming that's probably where they've done that too. And they've marked it with a footnote so that you can know that it's not what the Tanakh literally says. I'm all for marking what we do, and not just leaving the reader in ignorance. So we've had a little survey of what they're like. They're all very different. And we're going to look at some of them, not all of them, because alas, not all of them are the whole Tanakh, in terms of a passage from Shir HaShirim. And why have I chosen this? Because of art scroll, because this is the big problem with art scroll. Okay. What do you do with poetry, and how literal is, or paraphrastic, how non-literal is acceptable? At what point does something stop being a translation? And that's really illustrated by this. So we're just going to look at these the set of verses from Shir HaShirim. I'll just read it out in Hebrew. Shuvi, shuvi hashulamit, hashulamit, and you can hear the sh, sh here. Shuvi, shuvi, the nachazebach, ma techezu v'shulamit, kimcholot hamachanayim. You can also hear the rhythm. Ma yafu v'amai v'na'alayim bat nadib, and again, this is poetry. It's got a ba-dum, 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 a three stress per half of each verse. Shararech agan ha-sahar al yechsa ha-mazek, sorry, bitnech aremat chitim suga ba-shoshanim, shne shadai ki shne afarim ta'ame tzvi'a. So it's very beautiful, highly crafted, depends on the consonants, the repetition, the assonance, the rhythm to give the effect. That's hard to do in English. Now, we're not going to start with Art Scroll, I'll put it first, because we should start with a more literal one. So I've taken the New Jewish Publication Society. Turn back, O maid of Shulam. Turn back, that we may gaze upon you. Why will you gaze at the Shulamite in the Machanaim dance? How lovely are your feet in sandals, O daughter of nobles. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master's hand. Your navel is like a round goblet, let mixed wine not be lacking. Your belly like a heap of wheat, hedged about with lilies. Your breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. And you note, I've kept the footnotes in, that you have a little A here. And that says, with many manuscripts and editions. In other words, they have based this on very many manuscripts and editions of Tanakh, because they've done something a little bit unusual within the Machanaim dance. And then they've read others read like the Machanaim dance. They've chosen in. It'll be the difference between k and b in the Hebrew. Of course, letters that look very, very similar. And then they have noted meaning of entire line uncertain. They've got no idea. Okay. So that's a fairly, that's a freeish middle of the literal to paraphrase spectrum, perhaps. Let's go back to Art Scroll. The nations have said to me, turn away from God, this nation whose faith in him is perfect. Turn away, and we shall choose nobility from you. But I replied to them, what can you bestow upon a nation of perfect faith, commensurate even with the desert camps encircling? I don't pretend to know what that line means. But your footsteps were so lovely when shod in pilgrim's sandals, O daughter of nobles. The rounded shafts for your libations, abyss-like trenches, handiwork of the master craftsman. At earth's very center, your Sanhedrin site is a crescent basin of ceaseless flowing teaching, your national center, an indispensable heap of nourishing knowledge hedged about with roses. Your twin sustainers, the tablets of the law, are like two fawns, twins of the gazelle. Well, it doesn't take expertise in Hebrew to see that this is not a literal translation in the least. This is a targum. What they've done here is they have removed all the erotic and human references. It's all interpreted. It's based on Midrash, but it's all interpreted. So the two lovers of Song of Songs, the male lover and the female lover, again, from very, very early days, the male lover is understood to be God, the female lover, the people of Israel. There are also interpretations that the female lover is the individual soul. That's a medieval, more philosophical idea. So basing on this, for Art Scroll, there is no literal meaning. It doesn't count. And they say this in their introduction. They say there is no literal meaning to this. You can only read it in this way. Curiously, they asked for an introduction from Rabbi Mordechai Tendler. And that, weirdly, in the original Shir HaShirim single volume, they printed only in Hebrew and didn't translate. So I sat down and read it to see why they hadn't translated it. And I discovered that Rabbi Mordechai Tendler had said, of course, it has many levels of meaning. And one of them is the literary meaning, because the relationship between male and female is a sacred relationship and therefore was chosen as a metaphor for the relationship between God and the people of Israel. So Rabbi Tendler was saying the literal meaning the metaphor is equally important as the inner mystical meaning. And obviously that went completely against what Artsborough wanted to say. So having asked him for the introduction, they couldn't unask him. So they just left it in Hebrew so that you couldn't see what he was saying unless you are reading Hebrew. And of course, most consumers of Artsborough publications don't read Hebrew. So it's been mocked many, many times. And really, it sounds quite terrible. I know what they're trying to do, but I question the wisdom of trying to do that and pretend that that is a translation. If they wanted to say, we will not publish a translation of this, we will publish an interpretation of the true inner essence meaning of it, I would have no problem at all. But representing this as a translation doesn't do anyone any favors whatsoever. And that is the core of my beef with Artscroll. If you only want to have a Midrashic translation, I think you could do better than this too. It's inelegant in the extreme. And, you know, this bit about the rounder shafts of your libations, abyss like trenches. Ooh, it just sounds awful. It certainly doesn't give you any idea of the beauty of Shir HaShirim at all. So that is the Artscroll problem in a nutshell, really. And if they just labeled it a Targum, I think I'd be much happier about it. But many, many people, I think most people who have an Artscroll think it's a translation and they don't read the prefaces, then the Hebrew might not be up to noticing just how divergent this is from the original Hebrew. And that, I think, is a major, major problem. And let's have a look and see what some other translations do with this very difficult passage. Here we have the Living Nach. This is the successor of Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan's Living Torah. Return, return, O perfect maiden. Return, return, and let us look after you. How will you look after the perfect maiden? With rings of dancers. You might remember that is the Machanaim dance, so they have interpreted Machanaim as not a place name, but something to do with rings in dancing. Okay. How lovely are your feet in sandals, O daughter of nobles. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the handiwork of a craftsman. Your navel is a round goblet, which never lacks splendid wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat, hedged in with roses. Your two breasts are like two fawns, like twin deer. Not at all embarrassed about breasts, and this is a very orthodox translation, so, you know, it can be done. I sort of feel that Artscroll maybe embodies a certain Victorian repulsion at the idea of body parts, especially female body parts, which is somehow, again, very fundamentalist Christian. But this is not bad at all. This has a certain rhythm. It captures, it gives you as literal, perhaps, a translation as you can, given the fact that the original is not very clear. Like, what is this Machanaim thing? Is it a place name? Is it a description of a dance? What is it? It's not at all clear there. But this has a certain rhythm. Return, return, perfect maiden. Return, return, let us look after you. It's got a three, like the original. Not bad at all. They don't present it as poetry. As you can see, it's sort of presented a little bit as poetry and partly as prose. I'm not quite sure what their principles were there. But again, that might not bother you. Here is one we haven't mentioned so far because it's just a translation of Shir HaShirim. This is by Ariel Bloch and Chana Bloch, and I think they actually are poets in real life, if you like. So here is one that concentrates on the poetic qualities rather than literal, exact literal translation. Again, O Shulamite, dance again that we may watch you dancing. Why do you gaze at the Shulamite as she whirls down the rows of dancers? And again, Machanaim, possible place name, has disappeared down into rows of dancers here, okay? How graceful your steps in those sandals, O nobleman's daughter. The gold of your thigh shaped by a master craftsman. Your navel is the moon's bright drinking cup. May it brim with wine. Your belly is a mound of wheat edged with lilies. Your breasts are two fawns, twins of a gazelle. And you can see some interesting interpretation. Where did the moon come from? You might say, didn't see the moon in the original. Nobody else has got moon. This has got round JPS, and we'll see other things. I won't look at the article there. This is because the word concerned is Sahar. Sahar means a crescent, particularly a crescent moon. But it's clearly, it's Agan HaSahar is the basin of the crescent or the bowl of the crescent. So where some people have said, okay, that means round, the Blochs have tried to keep that moon flavor in, crescent moon. So again, you can see different translators' decisions, how to try and convey some of the metaphors used in the original, not smooth them out. Let's look at Robert Alter. Turn back, O Shulamite, turn back that we may behold you. Why should you behold the Shulamite in the dance of the double rose? And is your Machanaim again has now become double rose. How fair your feet in sandals, O daughter of a nobleman. The curves of your thighs like rings, the handiwork of a master. Your navel a crescent bowl. See what he did there? Crescent implies moon, so he's managed to do that quite nicely. Your navel a crescent bowl, let mixed wine never lack. Your belly a mound of wheat, hedged about with lilies. Your two breasts like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. And you can hear the rhythmic quality in that very much matches the Hebrew. So he has focused here on reproducing features of the Hebrew very, very closely, and making sure that reads quite fluently in the English. If we look at the New Koran, again, they've made the decision not to show it as poetry. They prefaced it by he. In other words, they've marked the male and female lovers' speech throughout, which is quite helpful to the reader because then you realize that this is a dialogue and you can see the back and forth. It's not always clear. Sometimes you have to work it out. I think actually the blocks did it possibly by the use of italics and non-italics. Though I'm not quite sure about that because it doesn't quite seem to work here. Okay, so the New Koran. Turn back, Shulamite. Turn back, turn. Let us see you. Why do you gaze at the Shulamite as if she were a Machanaim dancer? Yet another solution to the problem. What's this Machanaim? How lovely are your steps and sandals, prince's daughter. The turn of your thighs like jewelry, work of the artist's hands. Your navel a circular bowl, may it never want for wine. Your belly curved like bale wheat, bounded round with lilies. Your two breasts are like young twins of a she-gazelle. And they were doing pretty well with the rhythm, I think, till up to the last verse where it falls in a heap slightly. But I think they are making an attempt to look at the rhythm there. And again, if we look at the way they use footnotes, they address the problem, who is the Shulamite? We never find out. Possibly a woman from the time of Shunem, which immediately makes you ask, then why is he Shulamite and not Shunamite? Or alternatively, a feminine version of the name Shlomo, Solomon, which might be quite an interesting interpretation in the context of Shir HaShirim, which is, of course, Solomon's song. And when we get to Machanaim, they give you a nice little footnote. Literally, two camps, Machanaim may be the name of a place or a dance. So they acknowledge the fact that nobody quite knows what to do with Machanaim. Here you have a silent double rose. Here you have a silent rose of dancers. Here you have a silent rings of dancers. Nobody actually points out in the text, at least, that was Machanaim originally. Robert Alter will have something in the commentary below that you'll definitely mark that out. So you can see they're quite different styles. And some of them you may hate and some of them you may love. So that personal attraction or interest or quality or what you're looking for is really what tells you is the right translation for you. But as I would say once more, it really depends so much on your personal taste, but also the ability maybe to use more than one translation so that you're always aware it's a translation, it's not the original. And I think it is very helpful to do what I think of as translation triangulation. Use two or three. When they all suddenly go different, you know there's a problem in the Hebrew, and then you can explore that. If you only ever use one translation, you're unaware of the different interpretations, the different problems, the little sort of hiccups in the text that centuries of ingenuity have gone to unraveling and thinking about and trying to come to terms with. And using more than one translation lets you see those places. So I really, really would recommend, if you only have one in the house, go out and buy another one. Now, I've added a chart here that summarizes for most of the ones we talked about and a couple of extras. It tells you what you get. So you might get Tanakh with no Hebrew. You might get the Tanakh with Hebrew, but there are also editions without, etc. It tells you which books, if it's limited. The type of translation, that's down the bottom. One is a fairly traditional translation, probably with an academic base. Two is the Bobo Rosenzweig rhetorical, let's stick to the Hebrew and do a Hebrew English. And three is what I call traditionalist orthodox, which would be Art Scroll extremely, but also elements in the New Koran Tanakh. And elements in Kaplan's Living Torah as well. Diction, archaic or modern. Archaic is thee and thou, dost thou, etc. Modern is modern. Sources they used for the translation. And again, you can see the Art Scrolls only traditional Jewish. Most others, well, traditional Jewish and contemporary approaches or anything available. Then we also have a description of what you get in the notes, if there are any, and commentary, if there is any. So that might help you in making your decisions. I'm going to stop the show for a moment because you should have that at home anyway. That's sort of the later discussion. And now I can answer questions. So, Jay, you had your hand up. Can I go to you first?
Thank you. I don't type enough fast enough. A comment and a question. On the Bloch translation, in conventional poetry, italics represent direct address. So it seems like what they did is the first part seemed to be addressed to the woman, and the second part might be commentary that's not necessarily addressed to the woman. Who knows? But it's an interesting choice. It's like, if I've learned one thing, it's trying to understand the choices here. Yes. Fascinating, befuddling, all kinds of things.
If my that's all anyone has got out of the course, I'm happy. Translation is a series of choices. And I probably the best thing, I'm lazy, I didn't do it. I should have gone back to the book and have a look in their introduction where they probably explained very nicely where they'd use italics, and I didn't do that.
And so they're both
amazing
poets and translators. Quick question. I know it's a highly idiosyncratic translation, but I'm wondering what you think about, you know, Rosenberg and, you know, his work with Harold Bloom, et cetera. What you think of that?
I don't know enough about it. I did read a little bit about the Buber Rosenzweig project, but I didn't read an extensive amount about it. So I would have to go back and read everything to form an opinion at all. So I'm sorry.
I mean, with the whole Yahwist and all that kind of stuff, he only translates portions, but it's quite interesting. Yeah.
There's quite a lot about Buber's translation principles. I found, I think, again, if you go on something like Google Scholar and you Google Buber translation, you'll come up with all the articles.
Well, I just was wondering if there was a definitive treatment of it that you particularly like.
I can't remember. I used something they had in the library. I don't even know it was the best thing. It was what there was. It seemed reasonable to me. So it's really a field at the edge of my expertise. So you're going to need to make your own investigations on that one. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
What somebody else says, the only Bible I've had is Art Scroll. I've read Parshas Neil Shishim. Now, Paul, I've been doing it for nearly 2 years without any idea what a faithful rendering would be like. Well, again, you know, Art Scroll does suit some people. But if you really want to know what the Bible is saying, then get another translation as well and compare it with Art Scroll. And, you know, I think this is a very common experience that people, you know, why shouldn't people think that Art Scroll is telling them what the words say? Because that's what we all assume when we mean translation. It's fine. Get yourself another translation and then you can enjoy both. Here and there are great chunks where the Art Scroll doesn't do anything particularly, you know, unusual. When you get to Shir Shirim, no. I mean, the Midrash is beautiful, but the way Art Scroll does it doesn't help you at all. Doesn't even tell you about the Midrash, really. I might add that when Rashi did his commentary on Shir HaShirim, he did a double commentary. He explained the literal meaning, and then he told you the Midrashic meaning. And I wouldn't have a problem with Art Scroll if they did that and say had the literal meaning on the, and then a large commentary around it, and then you'd know where you were. The Art Scroll preface sounds almost like a justification of the Septuagint. I'm more for the Targums, really. Context of reviews made of his publication by the late Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Well, that's the new Koran. That's the new Koran. So we did discuss that. One useful feature of Art Scroll Siddur is their interlinear translation style, about which the Proudhon patented it, to make it a unique proposition of their publications. Indeed, yes, the interlinear Siddur, which can be very useful if you're new to davening in shul and you know, you're trying to get your Hebrew up, it can be very, very useful indeed. Mitsuda once published an interlinear, what was it? Interlinear Torah, I think, which again is quite useful if you're learning. Art Scroll Tanakh, page 1269, bottom page into Taruth, the great majority of people lead lives of quiet desperation. Oh, that's a quote. I think it's is it a quote from Tolstoy? It's a quote from a non-Jewish author. So it's fascinating that they've used it, I imagine, without attribution, because actually, if you look at Art Scroll, especially in the Barry Levy article, they use great chunks of the Encyclopedia Judaica without any attribution, because by them it's trait, but they use it. So yes, the leaves of quiet desperation is a very famous quote. If somebody wants to Google it and tell us where it comes from, a bit more. Oh, based on Torah, right? Yes. So that's fascinating that Art Scroll would use it, but I bet you they don't tell you it's based on Torah. Using Shesharim as an example is not really fair. This is true, because but it's the one where it's most problematic. So you can see it right away. You know, you have to be blind not to miss it. It's a problem. But it does do that elsewhere. Chazal have indeed said that that it has a metaphorical thing. Yes, but they never, ever denied the literal meaning of the text. And you could see that again from Rabbi Mordechai Tendler's introduction to the Art Scroll original single volume translation, where he said the literal meaning is sacred as well as the midrashical, the metaphorical meaning. So Art Scroll seem to have taken it into their heads to deny that basic tenet of Jewish belief that male-female relationships are also sacred. And that I find peculiarly Christian, because it is in the Christian world that we tend to find a denigration of human sexuality as something that's dirty and disgusting. In the Jewish world, we tend to celebrate it and say it's part of God's divine plan. And as Rabbi Tendler said, that's why this metaphor is chosen for the most intimate and sacred relationship between God and the Jewish people, because that's the most sacred and intimate relationship that human beings have. And that is the most sacred metaphor we possess. So to wipe it out is to follow a very Victorian Christian way of thinking, which is alien to Judaism. So I find it very, very odd. If Rashi and Chazal could cope with the literal meaning, while always saying that there was a derash meaning as well, an inner meaning, but never, never ignoring the literal or outer meaning, who are Art Scroll to decide that it's dirty and they don't want to write about it? It's really. I wonder if the unwieldiness of the Art Scroll Shesharim was intentional. I don't think so. Keeping it inaccessible, possibly even unattractive to read. I don't actually. Well, I see what you mean. You mean that possibly, I think you mean that maybe that would put people off reading Shir HaShirim and looking for literal translations. Maybe, in which case that's a bit of a condemnation too. I have to say, I know an awful lot of people whose biblical Hebrew improved enormously by trying to understand Shir HaShirim in the original when they were at Cheder and weren't allowed to read translations of it, which is an interesting idea. Somebody's written the only single volume Tanakh in Hebrew are New Koran and Art Scroll. The Art Scroll is far more commentary than it's New Koran. New Koran seems more literal. New Koran actually has a lovely section at the back, by the way, with maps and genealogies and weights and measures and pictures of the Mishkan. Very useful. I looked at that and was quite impressed by it. My only criticism is they have timelines, but they're not actually attached to absolute years. So it doesn't actually give you any dates or anything. It's just relative timelines, but it's very good. Study Bible has extensive notes commentary and less only in English. Is that that's probably the Oxford University Jewish Study Bible, yes, which is the NJPS translation. That's an academic one, not from one, but it's very, very good. And as you say, it's only in English, so it's usable on the side for, you know, looking up stuff. Some blog has a port in as address. Don't understand what a port in is. Found this now, it appears to be an elaborate translation with helpful notes. May well be, I don't know, I haven't looked at it. Wonderful, thank you. Where's the Samuel text filled in by the Dead Seal Scrolls? Does Magaman use this? No, they don't. I had a look, they don't mention it at all. It's the beginning of, I think, chapter 10. We talked about it, I think, when we did the Dead Sea Scroll session. We talked about this little paragraph that has no theological importance whatsoever, but has enormous narrative importance because it makes the story much more understandable. Is the chart in the notes for this lesson? Yes. That's the link is to that handout. Sonsino, oh yes, Sonsino is an old translation. Various people. There was somebody Cohen who did the Tanakh. Again, it's archaic. If you like these and thous, and you can cope with the dids and the thereofs, fine. But I think that's getting increasingly hard. Children don't understand them at all. I can't use an archaic diction. For some people, it's anything that sounds like the KJV is wonderful, and that's Bible to them. But if you want to understand it, I wouldn't recommend an archaic diction one at all. Steinsaltz edition, I've got it to review, but I haven't looked at it yet. Art Scroll makes a dog's breakfast of Mishlei. I've never actually looked at Mishlei in Art Scroll. Oh, there's the quote. Thank you so much. Henry David Torres quote, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. Yes. Absolutely. It's a very famous quote. I'm glad you tracked it down. I couldn't remember where it came from. And it's absolutely fascinating. The art scroll pinched it. And I'm guaranteeing it doesn't say it's Torah there, because they don't refer to any non-Jews at all. So I hope that's been useful. I hope that'll help you to select a new translation, or again, never throw away a translation. Just buy more. I've got about four or five, and I do when I'm using them for a class, I often hop between them, and I always put where the translation comes from. And occasionally I don't like the translation because it's not going to help me trying to explain a midrash or something. So I'll say, Robert Alter, I have altered line 6 or something, so that people can see what we're working off and what Hebrew word we're actually playing with in a midrashic explanation. But I think people should be much, much more conscious of the issues at stake with translation, and much, much more conscious of what they're using and what they're getting, because, it's very important. The stakes are high. It's got to be something you want to use, not something you're using under false pretenses or that isn't doing the job you need to do it, that you need the translation to do for you. So I'm hoping this course has helped to some extent, and that you're going to rush off and buy all sorts of new translations and enjoy them tremendously. It's enormous fun looking at different translations again. I never realized you could take it that way. That's fascinating. So it's a great sport. I recommend it to everyone. And thank you all so much for coming to this course. I've enjoyed it enormously. You've all asked me wonderful questions that made me think too, and been founts of knowledge. So thank you very much indeed. And I hope I see you at a future course. I'm going to be discussing with Jay what I'll teach next. So at some point or other, probably in the new year, I will do a new course. Thank you all so much. Bye bye.
Thank you. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.